You're tuned to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, Sister Spit, a queer feminist literary roadshow. Born 19 years ago here in San Francisco, Sister Spit has become a cultural institution. It's a gender-bending, traveling writer's cabaret that brings some of the most important queer and counterculture artists of the day, along with emerging writers, to universities, art galleries, community spaces, and other venues across the U.S. and in other countries. Performer and author Justin Vivian Bond calls Sister Spit like the Underground Railroad for burgeoning queer writers, not only in the van, but in the audiences trapped in the hinterlands of America and looking to escape. Sister Spit saves lives. And comic Margaret Cho calls Sister Spit heartbreakingly beautiful, sometimes funny, sometimes shattering, always revolutionary. We're going to hear some of this life-saving, revolutionary, and beautiful writing tonight. With me in the studio are Michelle T., one of Sister Spit's co-founders, and Ali Liebegott, one of Sister Spit's longtime members. They're armed with some of their latest writing and some blasts from the past. Award-winning writer Michelle T. co-founded Sister Spit in 1994. She's edited or co-edited four anthologies and has written seven books, the latest of which is Mermaid in Chelsea Creek, her first young adult fiction published this spring. She won a Lambda Literary Award for Best Lesbian Fiction for her 2000 novel Valencia, a film adaptation of which premieres in this year's Frameline San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival. In 2003, she founded Radar Productions, a nonprofit literary organization that nurtures and promotes queer literature. Welcome, Michelle T.
Hello.
Author and poet Ali Liebegott is managing director. Actually, she told me she's been promoted now to executive director.
She's been promoted. It's a little bit of a secret because we want to make sure she doesn't, you know, mess up or anything.
Executive director of
Radar.
And a longtime Sister Spirit participant. Her work has been published in many journals and anthologies. She's just out with her third novel, Cha-Ching, about a Sirmam Sir in the 1990s who leaves San Francisco and tries to find herself and love in New York. Her first two novels both won Lambda Literary Awards. It's hard to say literary, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
At least for me. The IHOP papers for fiction in 2008 and in 2006 for lesbian debut fiction, The Beautifully Worthless, which she describes on her website as a book-length poem. It's just been republished by City Lights. She teaches creative writing at Mills College in Oakland. Ali Liebegott, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Evening salutations.
Thank you both for being here. So let's start out with a short reading from each of you. And I, you know, forgot to ask which one of you wants to go first. We had all that time to do that before we went on the air. But Michelle, you've got a book in hand. You're grabbing it. Let's do it.
I'll just read a little bit of the introduction that I wrote for the Sister Spit anthology, since we're just talking about
Sister
Spit. Okay,
and I'm going to move this microphone just a little bit closer to you.
So I can relax.
Yeah, that's
okay,
it.
Okay, cool. Okay. So this is the introduction to Sister Spit Books, which is an imprint of City Lights, our first publication, which is an anthology featuring a bunch of the writers that have traveled with us since the 90s. So there's a lot of people in here, and this is from the introduction. I'm writing from inside of the 2012 Sister Spit van, careening down the 5, on our way to a show tonight at UC Santa Cruz. The students have requested that we all talk about class. Sister Spit has never taken a request before, but this is easy. Most Sister Spit shows are about class. About class and being female, or about class and not being female, about being trans, a faggot. There is feminism in everything, a punkness too. What's funny is that everyone is sort of perplexed about what they should do to fulfill this class requirement. One person reads every night about her broke family and the weird ways they got by in 1990s Long Island. Another reads about waiting on Castro clones at an all-night diner in San Francisco. What about the performance artist who goads our audience, so far California college students, to put money into a carved-out hole in a baby doll? Or the slam poet who lists the extreme ways his immigrant family reused every bit of plastic packaging they brought into the house. It's funny that there would be any stress about selecting a piece that explores class, but when it is wound so intimately into the fabric of your person, and hence your art, it can be as hard to recognize as your own speaking voice. But we all hear each other here in the van. Yeah, do that piece. Yeah, talking about having sex with a homeless person is totally about class. Yeah, that song you sing about working at the farmer's market counts as a piece about class. And so we bring our show to a packed auditorium at UC Santa Cruz, and without really trying, become the embodiment of so much of the theory these kids are being taught. In the morning, we convene with students and again discuss class. The things we share blow some of the students' minds, but our minds get blown too. I have a major revelation sitting there in this beautiful wooden queer center, redwood trees soaring outside the grand windows. If I'd gone to college, none of us would be here right now. Holy moly, it's true. Back in the 1990s, Sister Spit is what I did instead of going to college. Almost 20 years later, I'm still doing it, now bringing our lived example of outsider experience, of different ways of existing, living an artist's life, directly into universities nationwide. Every year, I call a different group of writers and performers from the wide pool of underground geniuses I'm deeply fortunate to know. For 1 month, we live together in a van. We take to the stage every night and bare our souls, expose our experiences in ways so unusual and artful it looks easy. We sell chapbooks, zines, books, and CDs from a table at the back of the room. We sell glass bottles for wishes. We sell posters and tote bags. Then we pack it all back up in our rolly bags and move on to the next town.
Wow, so that's a pretty good little description of what Sister Spit's all about.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the history.
And Allie, you've been involved with Sister Spit too. When did you get involved and how?
Well, I was living, Michelle and I met in the very early 90s. I think not long after she moved to San Francisco, we met in an open mic at the Paradise Lounge, that's no longer around. But and then I moved to New York. And when I moved to New York, Michelle had started the open mic with Cine, the Sister Spit open mic. But we remained friends, and I sent her sad letters.
So it wasn't Sister Spit that you met with.
No,
it was a different open mic previously.
Right, I'd known Michelle before she created that with Cine, and but when they did the first tour, she asked me to come, and I said yes, and so I've said yes every time since, I think. And so the first time I went was in 1997, which was the maiden voyage.
Yeah, right, the first time
the
ever.
The Ramblin' Road Tour.
Yeah.
Okay. Two vans.
13 people. Because I thought, if we aren't sure if this is sustainable and nobody has any money and we've never attempted this before, why not bring 13 people with us, you know?
It sounds like bike racing trips I did when I was, you know, like, I don't know, 19, and we would travel across the country. And at one point we were driving into, we had this big trailer with our bicycles in it, and we drove into this, in the middle of the night, in this windy road, we'd pull into this station, and this one of the wheels rolls from our trailer, rolls in front of us.
Oh, my God.
So I understand about the van breaking down.
Yeah. I mean, our very first van, we fundraised for it, you know, for a year to buy it. I mean, we were kids in our 20s. We had no money. We didn't have family money. We didn't have credit cards. You know, we really scrambled to make it happen. And we finally got this van. We're out on the road. We can't believe we've really pulled it off. And then the van just dies. The engine cracks. And it's
our own fault because...
You drove with no oil.
Yes, we did.
Be so terrifying.
At the time, and when Michelle says we fundraised for a year, that was to get like $1,000. So it was like $1,000 van. And
yeah.
Maybe there was a little too much drinking going on. Hey. And maybe the
Where were you when the van broke down?
Thanks for asking.
Yeah,
by.
Really.
That would be the Mississippi-Alabama border at midnight.
Escatapa, Mississippi.
It always happens in the middle of the night, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yes. Yep.
And so we ended up having to rent a budget rental van, cargo van, and the rest of the trip, just everyone sitting on the floor of the cargo van.
No
with
seats.
No seats. And you know what? The saddest part was, I don't think that was strange to anyone. We just accepted our
yeah.
fate and kept
yeah.
going.
We
that
really
sounds
did.
Like the bike tour. Some of us were sleeping on the floor underneath the seats. And that went for a few years, and then it kind of fizzled. Then it came back again later.
Yeah.
So how is the newer one different from the older one?
Oh wow, it's really completely different. I mean, I was working. I worked with a professional tour manager. Right out of the gate, bringing it back, who completely professionalized it and created some standards for us that we weren't able to create for ourselves.
So infrastructure standards.
Yeah.
But do you get the sense that what you're bringing to people across the country is just as, I don't know, in a way, revolutionary
yeah.
or life-changing now as it was
Absolutely.
In the 90s?
Yeah, I really, really do.
Yeah, I mean, I do too.
Yeah, we're bringing voices that are still marginalized, you know, and we're bringing them, especially going into universities. We are often the first group of people like us, a lot of kids have seen, you know, the first group of people who have our particular mixture of class backgrounds and, you know, queerness and outspoken, you know, feminism, like whatever our various identities and issues are and how outspoken and eloquent we are about it. We're often the first kind of view that kids have gotten of that. So it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me some, share some of the reactions you've gotten from
It's
people.
Great. I mean, sometimes we meet people. I remember on the tour we just finished in Chicago. I met people at that show who'd read like some small story I'd written for one of the anthologies Michelle had done the fashion one. I can't remember its name right now. What was the fashion?
It's So You.
It's So You.
I didn't want it to be called that.
It's anyway, there were, I had written a small story in that, and it just to meet people from all around that had maybe been following your work, but you didn't know it, you know. But we often have the experience of going places where people, like when we went to Bloomington, Indiana, like they, you know, maybe there's 40 people at the show and they've been fundraising, you know, for 6 months and coordinating to get us there because there is not queer things happening. And it's just, they're just dying for that kind of culture. And,
right.
you know, it's great to, I just love to be able to meet people from other places and to visit with, because I know as a person who like didn't have a lot of exposure to queer things, how just life-saving it feels to just be able to see someone who looks a little bit different. Than...
Right, right, yeah.
And now after doing it, we get people who saw us in the 90s come to our shows and are like, I've been following you guys since the 90s, along with, you know, these kids who are 21.
Yeah, so. Jolene from City Lights Book, she said, it's like, I just wanted to know about this. It's kind of like a punk rock band on tour, but they're poets and writers.
Yes.
It's exactly right. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It, with the whole behind the music drama and all.
So Allie, you mentioned that you, earlier that you had been involved and then you moved to New York for a while in the mid 90s. And that's kind of like the, heroine of your book, Cha-Ching, right? She moved
Whoa.
To New York in the 90s.
That just hit me now. That's weird. It is. In fact,
I was trying to make a smooth segue for you to read from Cha-Ching.
Segue. Are you sure it's not pronounced Segu?
I think it's French, but I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I'll read a little bit from Cha-Ching. I'll read from the very beginning, so I won't have to explain anything. But all right. Are you ready for me?
I'm ready.
Okay. It was 1994, the year of bad low blood sugar decisions. As soon as Theo was done watching her favorite episode of Top 25 Best 911 Emergencies, she planned to leave her empty San Francisco apartment and move to New York. She sat on the cold hardwood floor and absorbed the grave situation of a man who'd become trapped in the bottom of a garbage truck. A passerby had called 911 after hearing what sounded like human cries coming from the truck. Local police were instructed to pull over every garbage truck in a 3-mile radius of where the man had reported the cries. When the right one was finally found, a policeman stood at the rear of the truck and spoke clearly into his megaphone. Is anyone in there? Can you hear me? While two sanitation workers in bright orange vests snickered in the background smoking cigarettes. The second time the policeman called into the garbage truck, a tiny muffled voice said, Yes, sir, I'm down here. This was Theo's favorite episode because the TV show never discussed how a person might find himself trapped in the bottom of a garbage truck. She knew there were only a few explanations, mental illness, drunkenness, homelessness, or a combination of the three. But by not exploring any of the options, the TV show was saying, don't judge. We're all 5 decisions away from waking up in the bottom of a garbage truck. And when the man was pulled gently by his arms from piles of oozing plastic bags, the TV show did him the additional honor of digitally blurring his face to protect his anonymity. I'll stop there.
Okay. Without giving too much away, Theo ends up driving across country to New York. She has to get out of... Why does she have to get out of San Francisco? And
well, I think it's just like at the... I mean, do I ever explain that in the book? I'm not sure. I think she's just maybe like it's that thing of like you think you're going to move somewhere else and life's going to be better or different.
You're not going to take your problems with you. It's
wherever you go, there you are. So sad, isn't it? It feels like if you spend $3,000 moving across country, you should be someone different.
Yeah, maybe so. tell us a little bit about... Radar, too. Radar is, I should reintroduce what's going on here. That was Allie Liebegott, who just read from Cha-Ching.
That's Michelle T. Yeah. making. Do we have a Foley artist in the studio?
No, I don't know what that is.
A Foley artist? Radio guys who, when they had the radio plays and they'd have like, someone have two empty Folgers cans and they'd be like, a horse is coming.
Oh, clunk. I didn't know it was called a Foley artist because I see that in film credits, but I thought it was something different entirely.
God, that's amazing.
So we have Allie Liebegott here and Michelle T.
Foley artist. Sorry.
And you're listening to Out in the Bay. My name's Eric Jansen. Thank you. This is fun. What, and you... I definitely want Michelle to have you read a little bit from Mermaid mm-hmm. in Chelsea Creek.
Okay.
Because it's different. I mean, in the sense that it's specifically for young adult.
Adult
fiction. So do you want to read some of that now?
Sure, sure. A lot happens in this book. It's a very magical young adult book, fantasy book. There's mermaids, there's talking pigeons, there's witches, there's evil grandmothers, which a lot of people have a hard time with, seeing a grandmother as evil. But so it's a very...
And the very, I hate to say this because usually I read more of a book before a guest comes in, but I only read the prologue and the first chapter. But the prologue is this kind of neat thing about Chelsea being, so set us up. This is where you grew up, Chelsea, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I did.
And it's kind of a poor town. A lot of immigrants came there, and there are these older women there who are like, think that magic is going to come and the young people don't believe them.
Yeah, the whole idea, I guess, of rooting it is that there are these, the old people in the old countries had magic, and they brought them with it. They brought this magic with them as they emigrated, and then it kind of got washed away by the new modern lives, And
nice cell phones and crap like that.
Yeah, and it just turned into weird folklore and not true. But in my book, it's true, and there's somebody's going to come and sort of like remove this curse of sort of sadness and pain that like humanity just kind of maybe takes for granted as their lot in life, but is actually the result of a curse.
Okay, so now that I've just ruined your setup, go ahead.
No, you didn't. It's great. I mean, it's weird when you write a novel. It's like you're trying to keep so many balls in the air. It can be a little confusing to even figure out how to explain it, especially because I just wanted to read this part that's just between Sophie, who's the main character, and her best friend Ella, and they're at that point where they're sort of growing apart as friends as they kind of move from tween to teen. And Sophie has gotten punished by her mom. Her punishment is to hang out at the city dump that her grandmother owns, and that actually is going to facilitate all this discovery about what's really going on. But she's just bummed that she can't hang out at the beach with her bestie. They're talking on the phone. Hello? Ella was breathless at having run through the house. Hi, Sophie said. What's up? Nothing. Just a million people over here as usual. A curl can't get any space. I'm dying to get out of here. Are you having a Nick fit? Sophie asked. Never having smoked, Sophie didn't know what a Nick fit felt like, just that her friend claimed to have them. And once she started having one, it was all she thought about, all she talked about, until she smoked a cigarette. Sophie thought Nick fits were strange and boring. No way, my house is so smoky with everyone over here. I just had a cigarette right in my bedroom and no one even knew. Ella sounded proud, having found a way to make the chaos of her home work for her. I got burned at the beach today. It was hot, huh? Sophie had forgotten about the beach. She was surprised to feel not a single pluck of envy at having missed something. How was it? How do you think it was? Awesome. There are so many cute guys. One gave me the rest of his pizza. He was so wicked cute. What's his name? Junior. Which is crazy, right? Because I'm a junior. Like, my mother's name is Junior, and he's a junior because he's named after his dad, like his real name is Tony or something. But I was like, Junior, that's got to mean something. Sophie paused, waiting for Ella to bust up laughing. Was she joking? She sounded like an airhead. Listening to herself talking to Sophie, Ella could hear how dumb she sounded, but she couldn't help herself. There was something exhilarating about giving herself over to such talk and feelings. The boy's attentions had electrified her, his steady dark eyes and his husky voice as he traded his pizza for a cigarette. She could feel another girl rising inside her, dumber in some ways and smarter in others, haughty and confident, a flirt. She supposed she'd flirted with the boy, and it had worked. He'd seemed both flirtier and shyer when he'd left her, after smoking a cigarette down to the filter and tossing the butt into the frothy waves. Ella's body buzzed from the interaction like a hive of yellow jackets swarmed through her, beating their tiny wings. The rash her last scrubbing... Oh, God, now see, she has OCD, and I'm just, like, throwing that in here. I should just end there. So, yeah, I'll just end there, because then I got to get into how she has OCD and stuff.
Okay. So how is it different writing for young adults than for, older adults? Because time only goes in one direction, as Allie has told us many times.
Yes, it does.
That's the theme of the evening. It wasn't that more difficult. I feel like I understand like a teenager's perspective in a way. I didn't really trip out very much on what was appropriate or what wasn't. I just kind of wrote the book. Sitting down for it to be a young adult book, there's the parameters of what you're not going to, the kind of things you're not going to put in the book are already there. There's a lot of gray area, which I definitely play in a lot. But it wasn't, fiction is really much more challenging to me than writing memoir. Mm-hmm. But whether that fiction is adult fiction or young adult fiction doesn't necessarily make that big of a difference.
So was there a particular reason that you set out to write a young adult fiction rather than, did you have something in particular you wanted to say to young people, or you just kind of just started writing and it just happened that way?
Well, I think I just I really resonate with like a young voice, you know. The other fiction book that I wrote, Rose of No Man's Land, is a novel, and it's also two teenage girls. But it's funny, it's like almost a marketing thing, because that publisher who put it out didn't have a young adult department. It just got put out there as an adult book, but it's about teenage girls, you know. I definitely wanted to try my hand at writing something a bit commercial to see if I could do that. And I definitely didn't think I could write a commercial adult book, because I just don't understand the adult world. But I felt like, oh, maybe I could do that with a kid's book. And I had read His Dark Materials books, the Philip Pullman series, The Golden Compass is part of it, and just got really inspired by the world he created, and thinking like, well, what would my magical world look like if I was to transform the worlds that I'm familiar with, which is like Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to reading
it's
beyond
really,
the first two
really
chapters.
It's really, really great. I'm about two-thirds of the way through right now, and it's good. Like someone, it's like I keep having this experience as someone who's known Michelle forever and known her writing to like, just like really appreciate the grittiness, you know, the back talks about the grittiness and, you know, what's in YA books and what isn't, you know, and I just really appreciate the class perspective that's in it and just the kind of the real issues. I guess I feel like, what's that quote by the guy from Where the Wild Things Are, Maurice Sendak, where he talks like, you know, don't talk down to kids and don't like, you know, insult them in that way as if like nothing bad's ever going to happen to them. And
right.
Or already hasn't happened to
right.
them.
Already hasn't, yeah,
totally.
So you mentioned gritty. I mean, you both mentioned gritty, and I'm kind of wondering, is this a common thread of the sister spit contributors?
It is.
And participants?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and that grittiness can manifest in different ways, but we have definitely always taken people who have some sort of working class background, and that's really a part of their writing. I mean, not entirely, you know, we've taken people of all different class backgrounds, but you know, even people who necessarily haven't had, you know, grittier class backgrounds, there's still something about the way they experience life mm-hmm. and the way they see it where there's definitely like an edge to it.
They could be rich, but as long as their parents were alcoholics or something like
yeah, that. Yeah, exactly. Like they got some sort of mental problem, you know, something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
It damaged
So, Allie, your uncle was a blackjack dealer. Is that why gambling addiction plays so large in Cha-Ching? Cha-Ching! Oh, that's from the jackpot thing, isn't it?
Cha-Ching!
Cha-Ching. Yeah.
Money.
Right, exactly. Making money. My grandparents, when I was like 13, I think my mother said the family's Italian, and so they like to live next door to each other for their whole lives, like everyone, you know. So we grew up living with my grandparents, and then they moved to Las Vegas to retire, and then the rest of the Italian family went and migrated out there, and this was in the mid 80s, so you could really like live pretty cheaply in Las Vegas. It was like appealing to retirees. There was like no state tax,
right.
A mobile home for like a nickel, and you know, the whole shebang. So my uncle also moved out there, and he was in the Air Force his whole life, but as he retired, he was living out there, and he became a blackjack dealer. And but I've spent a ton of time in casinos for other reasons we won't get into on the air.
We won't need to talk about that.
Why bother?
You've won lots. That's why you have to work three jobs now.
That's why I'm wearing this mink coat.
So I have to ask you before we run out of time, what's a surmamser?
A surmamser, that was coined because I was on an airplane once, and stewardess came down the aisle and said, "Can I get you a drink, sir, ma'am, sir?" She was just like caught in this loop, not knowing like what my gender was. And it was like so amazing because you could just see like she couldn't. It was like she tripped and she couldn't stop. Her brain was just like flipping back and forth. And so I just thought it would be a great term for someone who's actually, Michelle has a sir, ma'am, sir in Mermaid in Chelsea Creek.
There is a sir, ma'am, sir. Yeah,
one of the characters is
named as such, or just
in the book, her name's Angel, but like it's a sort of a masculine looking woman who, I guess it doesn't have to be that way, but that's how it was originally coined, was like sort of a masculine-looking person.
Okay, so I'm going to put the photos of both of you on our website, outonthebay.com, and
you can
and
guess
let listeners
which
guess
me.
Which is
yeah.
which. So a Radar. So Sister Spit is this national tour. Radar is kind of, is it fair to say, like a local version that doesn't travel?
Well, Radar is sort of the umbrella that that covers and contains Sister Spit and a whole bunch of other programs. So what happened is that, you know, I was doing Sister Spit, you know, the tours, and I was also doing, you know, all of these monthly reading series in San Francisco. I was doing a lot of literary programming, just me, and had been for many years. And a mentor who worked in nonprofit said, you are an arts organization. You have that sort of calendar, you know, you do more programming than a lot of organizations that get tons of funding. And he sort of showed me how to professionalize and create an organization that can hold and support Sister Spit, as well as the Radar Reading Series, which happens, you know, monthly at the San Francisco Public Library. It has for the past 10 years.
Where can people find out about Radar if they want to go to one?
RadarProductions.org.
Cool.
You can find out about everything. Sister Spit, the Reading Series, the Valencia film that's premiering on Friday. If you didn't get your tickets, it's too late for Friday, but a third show has just been added on the 24th.
And that's a film adaptation of your
book, Valencia.
Novel, Valencia.
Yeah.
It was a novel or a
it was
more
a
of
memoir,
a memoir.
But don't tell the Lambdas, they'll take my fiction award away.
Okay. And City Light's 60th anniversary is this Sunday. What's going on there?
There's going to be all kinds of snacks and treats, and there's going to be jazz music, I think, and tons of authors. I just feel like any writer in San Francisco, every writer is going to be
gonna
there.
There's going to be Sir Mamsers milling about.
Lots of red hot Sir Mamsers. It's going to be a really great time.
And you've got another event in Jack Kerouac Alley is the alley that's between... between Vesuvio's and City Lights Books, right on Columbus there, this little alley. And there's something going on later in July. What's that?
It's going to be like this epic Sister Spit event where we take over Jack Kerouac Alley and we're programming, like, we're just bringing in, like, 20 performers to read at it. And it's just going to be this all day, like, three-hour, really fun event.
July 28th, between, I think, 2 and 4.
Yeah.
So come on out.
Yeah, 2 hours of just, like, all your favorite performers just hopping on the mic for a second.
Okay. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Ali Liebegott, author of Cha-Ching and many
not
other
gay.
Books.
Not gay.
Not gay. Queer.
No, I'm just kidding.
And Michelle T., author of Mermaid in Chelsea Creek and many other books, and co-founder of Sister Spit. If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on the site and about a dozen of our favorites from our 8 years on the air, including interviews with John Waters, Ang Lee, Leslie Gore, Matthew Shepard's mother, Judy Shepard. There's even a feature on Liberace in there. We've been producing Out in the Bay for more than 8 years as an independent production, not a KLW staff production. Out in the Bay receives no funds from KLW, so we your financial support. It's easy and tax deductible on our website, outinthebay.org. Hit the donate button and make a contribution, big or small. Don't forget matching funds from your employers. There are also ways you can help us that do not involve your money. That's right. We can use your help and expertise in many other ways. There's info at the bottom of our donate page and on our homepage, outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KLW, our host station, for studio use and airtime, and tonight's engineer, Eric Wayne. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616. Out of the Bay is also supported in part by the San Francisco Frontrunners 34th Annual Pride Run, a 10K and 5K run in Golden Gate Park, June 29th, the Saturday of Pride weekend. It's a co-sponsored by local dentist Peter Farmer and by Wells Fargo financial advisor Dan Jornstad. The Pride Run's fun, not competitive, although there are some prizes for top places, and a healthy start to a weekend that can be pretty crazy. It's a benefit for Larkin Street Youth Services, helping queer and straight homeless youth in San Francisco. Again, June 29th, find info on the Pride Run online at sfprideRun.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and Marilyn at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Ali Liebegott and Michelle T. and their books and other City Lights books and events, check out the City Lights website, citylights.com. For more info about Sister Spit, go to radarproductions.org. Next week on Out in the Bay, experts' perspectives on the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in the marriage cases. Join us.